You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is episode 40, and this is your host, Brian McClanahan. And this episode covers the week of August 29th through September 2nd, 2016. Glad to have you back on the program. We have a couple of really interesting articles to talk about this week. But before we do that, I'd like to remind you that we exist on your generous contributions alone. If you would like to help us keep this podcast running, keep the website up and going, keep our programs accessible for the public, please make a generous contribution at the Abbeville Institute, www.abbevilleinstitute.org. All of your contributions are fully tax deductible to the full extent of the law. Also, remember to like us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Please share our material. It's how we change minds. Our goal is to help people explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition and to discuss some of the things that other people won't discuss, right? So we can keep that going. Help irritate those out there who don't think like us and maybe change a few minds in the process. Okay, so let's talk about what we had this week. There was a theme later in the week, but the first article for the week was entitled Slavery in Pennsylvania, and it was written by yours truly. And this particular piece focuses on, most of the piece is from a primary document that was written in 1750 by a German named Gottlieb Mittelberger. But the particular focus of the piece is on indentured servitude in North America, which is often a neglected and little discussed part of North American slavery. Why is it little discussed or why is it neglected? Because eventually it died out. But what most people don't realize is that indentured servitude continued almost all the way up until the American War for Independence. And it affected quite a large number of people. And it was a forced labor institution. You wouldn't find it in very many areas outside of outside the North. Right, so this was a northern forced labor system. The South had already adopted African slavery, which, of course, gets all the attention in American labor history when you start talking about forced labor. But and often what you have, even in your textbooks or your courses, your college courses, high school courses on American history, they're going to gloss right over this period and right over this subject because, well, these people could get free after a time and it wasn't as pervasive as African slavery, so and it affected only Europeans, and so we're just not going to worry about that. But it is a interesting part of American labor history, and it should not be glossed over. If we're going to talk about forced labor in America, then we should look at the entire picture, which would involve essentially what were European serfs. Now, how did this work? Well, Mittelberger gets into it. These people would be on a ship coming over to North America. They couldn't pay for their passage, so when they got here, they were forced to stay on the ship until they could be purchased off. And they had to remain until somebody bought them. And if they were sick, they were not going to be purchased very quickly. They could remain on the ship for 2 to 3 weeks. Oftentimes, they would die. And if they could pay for their passage, they would get off the ship. But this is where your slave market began, essentially on the ship. And this is what he says. Every day, Englishmen, Dutchmen, and High German people come from the city of Philadelphia and other places in part from a great distance, say 20, 30, or 40 hours away, and go on board the newly arrived ship that has brought and offers for sale passengers from Europe, and select among the healthy persons such as they deem suitable for their business and bargain with them how long they will serve for their passage money, which most of them are still in debt for. When they have come to an agreement, it happens that adult persons bind themselves in writing to serve 3, 4, 5, or 6 years for the amount due by them, according to their age and strength. But very young people, from 10 to 15 years, must serve until they are 21 years old. All right, so they actually engage in a contract to sell their labor. So this is different from African slavery, which was forced. There was no contract. People were deciding to engage in this, but they couldn't get off the ship unless they did it. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Many parents must sell and trade away their children like so many head of cattle. For if their children take the debt upon themselves, the parents can leave the ship free and unrestrained. But as the parents often do not know where and to what people their children are going, it often happens that such parents and children, after leaving the ship, do not see each other again for many years, perhaps no more in all their lives. So here we have a slave market, and the parents actually, this is a split and sale of families. When people arrive who cannot make themselves free but have children under 5 years, the parents cannot free themselves by them, for such children must be given to somebody without compensation to be brought up, and they must serve for their bringing up till they are 21 years old. Children from 5 to 10 years who pay half price for their passage must likewise serve for it until they are 21 years of age. They cannot therefore redeem their parents by taking the debt of the latter upon themselves, but children above 10 years can take part of the parents' debt upon themselves. A woman must stand for her husband if he arrives sick, and in like manner a man for his sick wife, and take the debt upon herself or himself, and thus serve 5 to 6 years, not alone for his or her own debt, but also for that of their sick husband or wife. But if both are sick, such persons are sent from the ship to the sick house, but not until it appears probable that they will find no purchasers. As soon as they are well again, they must serve for their passage or pay if they have the means. And this is again where it gets into the split and sale of families. It often happens that whole families, husband, wife, and children, are separated by being sold to different purchasers, especially when they have not paid any part of their passage money. Now, he mentions if someone in this country runs away from his master who has treated him harshly, he cannot get far. Good provision has been made for such cases so that a runaway is soon recovered. He who detains or returns a deserter receives a good reward. And earlier in the piece, I mentioned that northern newspapers ran ads all the time for runaways, and that Benjamin Franklin himself was actually a runaway at one point. He was indentured to his brother, and so he could have been legally reacquired by his brother if he wanted to. In fact, Franklin dabbled in slave trading at one point. And of course, northern merchants made a killing on the African slave trade. This is how they lined their pockets. And when, this is something I didn't bring up, but oftentimes when northerners were ending the institution, they were just selling their slaves down south. So the institution of slavery was an American institution, not just a southern institution, and it was very complex. And when you look at not just the forced labor itself, but the trade of slaves, and even northerners, and this is when I made a presentation on this topic at our Charleston conference in February, northerners were making quite a lot of money, northern Puritans, on Caribbean slave plantations. They may not have had slaves here in North America itself, but you had a large number of northerners who were making high profits on plantations in the Caribbean. And so there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy coming from the north in this period of time. They also treated Indians very harshly and used them as slaves. So the institution of slavery was pervasive in the entire North American colonies, not just the South. And unfortunately, oftentimes what you get is a picture of slavery that only focuses on the South. So if we actually are going to be honest about the institution, if we look at Indian slavery, if we look at indentured servitude, if we look at African slavery, this was an American institution, not a Southern institution, which is why I wrote this particular piece, because in that way, when the complexity comes out, the focus can move away from the South and on all of America, and which would change, I think, perspectives about Southern history. All right. Tuesday, we had a very interesting article, particularly from a historical perspective. This one didn't get a whole lot of traffic in terms of people sharing it around or liking it, but it's a really interesting piece. And the title is Who Won the Webster-Hayne Debate of 1830? This is one of those pivotal debates in American history where you have Daniel Webster of Massachusetts and Robert Hayne of South Carolina debating in the Senate about the issue of nullification. And if you read the textbooks on the issue, well then, Webster mopped up, right? He cleaned Hayne's clock. He made this great speech where everyone says, oh yes, resounding, you know, clap, 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 resounding. Daniel Webster won the debate, and he was the better orator, the better statesman. And so this piece is by Scott Trask, who was one of Clyde Wilson's students at South Carolina, and he wrote this as a paper for Dr. Wilson back in 1992, and never been published. Basically, what he shows in this paper is that that's not necessarily accurate. Historians have said, well, based on their own perception, because of the flowery language that Webster used, because of the oratory skills that he had, that Webster won the debate. But when you read the contemporary accounts, it wasn't so certain. In fact, many contemporary accounts point to Hayne winning the debate, that he was on better legal and constitutional footing than Daniel Webster. Daniel Webster made some very flowery statements. I mean, these grand statements about unionism and Americanism and these type of things. Of course, his very famous phrase, "Union and liberty, now and forever, one inseparable," created this spirit of nationalism. But even though that phrase has been, you know, used over and over again, it wasn't so certain that Webster won the debate at the time. Now, some people thought he did, but as Dr. Trask brings up, that's not necessarily true. Many newspaper accounts had Hayne winning the debate, and Webster the loser. It depends on which section of the country you're looking at, too. The northern press, or what you would say the eastern press, tended to support Webster. And as Trask points out, historians have generally attributed the national Republican reaction cited above as being common to the nation as a whole, with the exception of South Carolina and other deep South states. He says, though, yet the reaction of the debate among those of all sections of the country who were generally supportive of the Jackson administration was overwhelmingly favorable toward Benton and Hayne and antagonistic toward Webster. So Thomas Hart Benton was another participant in this debate. And of course, John C. Calhoun would later debate Daniel Webster and in many ways cleaned his clock on this particular issue. So, and it wasn't just in the South that that you had people saying that Hayne won. Hayne received support also from the New Hampshire Patriot, New Hampshire. This paper published a letter from a citizen of the state who had witnessed the debate. He praised Benton's splendid display of eloquence and Hayne's successful rebuttal of Webster's tirade against the South. Quote, that's a quote. He claimed that Hayne provided an immense service to the Republican cause, and he hoped that both Benton and Hayne's orations would be published in all our Republican papers to gladden the hearts of our northern democracy. He also received support from Democratic Republicans of the Middle States. This is one thing that I think needs to be pointed out. People don't realize about newspapers in the 19th century. They were openly partisan. There was no objectivity. A newspaper was owned by an individual, and that individual proudly displayed who they were. And the editorials and the letters that would come into that paper, even the news articles, would slant towards their perspective. They didn't make any claims about being, you know, fair and balanced like we have in news today. And this was actually preferable. It'd be better if our news sources would just say, look, I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter, and this is my slant. Or I'm a Republican supporter, a Democrat supporter, and here's my slant. But what we have are people trying to hide behind objectivity, and that great noble dream of objectivity actually works against news, because what happens is the people that are going to be slanted one way or another will sometimes try to give equal time to the other side, and they really shouldn't do that. The other side has plenty of other people talking about it. And we don't need objective news. We need news. And then people could filter through and look at things and say, okay, well, this is coming from this slant or this is coming from that slant. At least they're open about it. I think that is one thing that where you have these news shows where you have someone like Rachel Maddow, who's obviously on the left. She's not hiding it. Other people on the right, generally on the right, neoconservatives, most of them. But I mean, even, you know, we'll just take the mainstream people like Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh. They're obviously on the right, and that's good. I mean, these are people know who they are. And so it's okay. We can listen to it and say, okay, we know the slant we're getting. We know if we listen to Rachel Maddow, we're going to get the left slant. And if we want to listen to that, we want to say, what's the left thinking? Well, there you go. If you listen to the other side, you know, if you want to say that Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity are quote-unquote conservative, well, then you're getting their side, right? You're getting their perspective on things, and so you know it. But if you go on and just listen to a bland CNN newscast, they're going to say, well, we're objective. Well, they're really not. Or MSNBC or Fox News or whatever it is. There's no objectivity. And I think that's the thing that people just need to realize and just be open about it. These news networks need to be open. If you get the New York Times, you're going to get a slant. You get the Washington Post, you're going to get a slant. If you read the New York Post, you're going to get a different slant. Or the Washington Times. That would be better. And 19th century news was better. And it's actually much more enjoyable to read. If you ever get a chance to go out and read 19th century newspapers, they're a lot of fun because they're open about who they are. And they hammer the other side with really good stuff. So that's what Dr. Trask is getting into here. The Jackson papers tended to support Benton and Hayne, whereas the Whig papers, the National Republicans, we don't have the Whigs yet, the National Republican papers tended to support Webster. The Democratic Republicans and the National Republicans were at this point. We hadn't had the Whigs yet because we hadn't had the split with Jackson. But those National Republicans, a lot of them are going to become Whigs. And they're going to tend to... Well, what's interesting, though, is the Whigs in South Carolina would still support Hayne. So the Whig Party is a very complex thing. This is a very interesting piece, though, because it gets into this idea of, you know, who do you believe? Who do you believe? You're gonna go out and you're gonna read the news. Well, who's right? Who's accurate in that, in the portrayal of the news? And in this particular case, you're gonna see that history is biased. There was actually a book written years ago by a man named Novick, and it was entitled "That Noble Dream," and it was about historical objectivity and how no history is unbiased. All history is biased, and the people that are often cited as the true experts have major biases. Eric Foner is a communist. James McPherson is a neo-abolitionist, or, you know, what you would say is someone who generally supports the northern side. There's others that Kenneth Stamp that Novick points out from that. That's what he calls them, neo-abolitionists. So, and then there's the people that are, you know, the what they call the blundering generation school. People like Avery Craven, who didn't necessarily buy into this quote-unquote neo-abolitionist school that thought the war was a little more complex. Maybe it was a political conflict more than anything else. People like Michael Holt. So you have different schools of thought in history, and those who aren't that savvy or don't go to graduate school or don't, you know, just enjoy history and pick these books up and start reading them, they just think, well, I read it in the textbook, so it's got to be true. I saw an article a couple of days ago. It was a sports writer, and he has a little section where he talks about books that he's reading, and he mentioned James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, and he reads these things, and he writes reviews, and he said, this is such a great book. It's the best book ever written on the war. And it does have a lot of good information in it, but you are getting a slant with James McPherson. He is fair at times, but for the most part, he's going to have a northern slant. And so you got to know that going in. But this is where I think articles like this, Scott Trask wrote, punches holes in that narrative. Well, I mean, there isn't just one view of this. You know, history is gray. It's not black and white. It is shades of gray. So we have to understand that, and this is why we're trying to do these things, to punch holes in the narrative, whether it's slavery in Pennsylvania, indentured servitude, or whether it's this Webster-Hayne debate. We're trying to punch holes in the nationalist narrative that's been created after 1865. Now, kind of on that theme, we have a piece on Wednesday. It's entitled by Clyde Wilson, entitled "More Deja Vu: Circa the George W. Bush Years." And he talks about the votes in the Senate about immigration and amnesty, and he points out that when you look at the votes, I mean, it just looks like there's this group for and a group against. But really what you get into with that are votes by section. And it's really interesting. He breaks this down. And he said, you know, the vote, this is from the George W. Bush years now, but the vote against, there was a vote for an amnesty bill. The vote passed the Senate 62-36. And you have, if you look at who voted against, four of those 36 against were from Democrats from West Virginia, Michigan, Nebraska, and North Dakota. 32 Republicans voted against the bill, and they were from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arizona, Nevada, Wyoming, Montana, Utah, Colorado, Kansas, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire. And he says the South was the only part of the country to give a majority vote to the patriotic side, though with considerable help from the Plains and Rocky Mountains. And he says this was the same in 1965 when you had an immigration bill there. And then he has another piece, removes Ford, and says, look here, it happens again. And he breaks down the vote. And he points out that, again, the South was tending to vote one way and the North another. So he concludes, clearly the South and the Mountain West are the only regions left where the old America is robust enough to contend for dominance. And the South and the Mountain West already have been and are being adulterated by immigrants from the Third World and the Northeast. And he says, over time, this will eliminate any possible social and cultural base for conservatism. He says the powers that be like it that way, agreeing with Karl Marx that a people separated from their history are easily persuaded. We can hope that as time moves on, conservatism will enjoy an American revival, but don't hold your breath. Have a nice day, and remember to press 1 for English. So, this gets into the idea, you know, if you had more regional governments in America, if you decentralized, which is something that we talk quite a lot about, if you made things smaller, what would America look like if the South was able to control its own destiny, or the Northeast, or the West? What would these areas look like? Now, the Northeast is not so concerned about it because they control the government, for the most part. And so they can dominate. This is why Americans are angry, because we're, you know, most of America, close to 50% of America, the American population, is being dominated by about 50% of the population, swinging one way or the other. So this is why maybe decentralization would work better, because the people in their own regions and their own states could control their own destiny and have legislation that better reflected their culture. But what we have are people trying to have a top-down nationalist approach, one-size-fits-all policy for America. And this just doesn't work. You can't govern 320 million people with 435 people. Or if you count the president and the Supreme Court, you know, 445 people. Or 545 people when you count the Senate. 545 people. And when you just look at a quorum, which is a bare majority, you're getting into much lower numbers than that. So we have a problem in America, and that problem generally is that America is too big. And we have a great YouTube video on that. If you go to our YouTube channel, there's a short little discussion about this. Is America too big? So this gets into an article we ran on Thursday, which was originally published in the Southern Partisan magazine in 1997 by the late Bill Cawthon. And he brings up that what would the South look like? The question is, what would the South look like if it was an independent nation today? If the Southern people, which he generally considers to be a nation, had their own government. And so he points out politically on various issues, from immigration to school prayer to abortion to women in combat, welfare benefits, gun control, a balanced budget, line item veto, taxes, foreign policy. How would the South generally votes against the prevailing norm in America? And so if the South was independent, it would be able to control its own destiny in these particular areas. And when people say, well, this is just far-fetched, it can't happen, he looks at population. The census South would be one of the largest countries in the world. The Congressional Quarterly South would be just a little bit smaller than Mexico. And 11 states South would be just a little bit smaller than Germany. So it would be about the 12th or 13th largest country in the world. So could it work? I mean, if we think that a country that's small, when we have smaller countries than it, France would be smaller than the South, but yet it's a country, it works. The United Kingdom is smaller than the 11 states South, and yet it works. We don't have to have these mega states to have a country that works. In fact, you can make a case that smaller countries work better. And when you look at economic output, if you look at the Census South, or even if you go smaller, the 11 state South, and he talks about the Census South, which would be include places like Oklahoma. The Census South would have the third largest economy in the world. The third largest economy in the world. That's pretty amazing. Now, this is from 1997, so some things have changed a little bit, but not much. The third largest economy in the world. So could that South exist? Well, absolutely. It wouldn't be destitute. And you look at the shifting structure of American economy, and a lot of people are coming to the South because they like Southern laws in terms of labor and taxes and these type of things. So you would have a lot of interest in setting up shop in the South, whereas the North would lose some of that. So this is a really interesting piece because it breaks down all the different areas that an independent South would be better suited to the Southern people themselves. And Southerners, I mean, we're looking at, Donald Trump phenomenon right now. Donald Trump has a lot of support in the South. And Southerners don't believe they're really represented that much. And they're not. This is why Trump is getting such large numbers of record numbers of support. Now, this is generally, he does have support across, different races and backgrounds. His largest support is coming from, white, middle-class, and working-class Americans who don't feel like they have a voice in American politics. And so maybe they're, maybe they're underrepresented in Congress, maybe they're in their states, whatever the case may be. Maybe they don't like the global elite strategy that's going on. Maybe they don't feel like the corporate America suits them. They look at immigration and other things as problematic for their future security. And so, you have large demographic groups that are saying, well, I mean, we're not represented. The 50% is abusing us. And of course, then you also have people that are outside of that that think taxes are too high. And, people who are the laboring class think that having large numbers of illegal immigrants damages wages and working conditions. So this is a really interesting phenomenon. But here in 1997, almost 20 years ago now, again, a few things have changed here, but not a whole lot. The South still tends to vote differently than the rest of the country and support policies differently from the rest of the country. So Bill's conclusion is that the only hope is for an independent South if we want to have a voice. If we really want to have representative government, then an independent South would be the best solution for that. Now, is this going to happen? Probably not in anyone's lifetime that's listening to this podcast. People have to change minds. The instant reaction to this as we ran this on social media was, that's treason. The North would just invade and kill you. This is probably true. This is how people look at it. But I think the views are shifting. 10 years ago, you would not have had a discussion about, say, for example, nullification as being an even possible. But it's possible now. States are doing it all the time. Maybe in another 10 years, people will start actually looking at decentralization, meaning independence, secession, as we saw Brexit. I mean, this is now a real discussion. Can states do these type of things? What about the will of the people? If there's a referendum and a vote and people say, look, we don't want to be part of this union anymore. And it's peaceful. We just want to go our own way. You can keep your union. We just want to have our own government. That's self-determination. This is the American principle. And so people are actually starting to look at this. So maybe 10 years or 20 years, people will really be seriously considering this, particularly as millennials are realizing that, well, the government really doesn't represent them. They're disaffected voters or they're not voting. They understand that the game is rigged. I mean, look at the Democratic Party process. Hillary Clinton was going to get the nomination no matter what. The game is already rigged. These Bernie Sanders supporters, who are misguided in their economic views, but still they have something real to talk about here. They're not represented. Maybe it'd be better if they could have their socialist utopia in Vermont or California or Massachusetts, and that these conservatives that are constantly in the way could just have their own government. You could have your own governments all over the place, and wouldn't that be better? So this idea of a South, an independent South, is an interesting idea. Again, it's just discussion of what a South would look like. Is it going to happen? Probably not anytime soon. Maybe never. But at least it's putting the seed out there. Hey, maybe, you know, governments, maybe smaller is better. You know, as Kirkpatrick Sale says, we need to look at the human scale of things and not just think we need these mega states. All right, Friday we ran a piece, Secession Without Civil War, by Philip Lee, and he talks about a certain part of District of Columbia that seceded from the rest of the District of Columbia in 1846, and the North didn't invade. They didn't do anything about it. Why? Because that secession had no economic ramifications to the North. So he basically says, look, the reason the North invaded the South was not to save the Union, but to save their wallets, and they really didn't care about slavery at all. At that point, I mean, there were abolitionists out there, but he's pointing out that the Union cause was for the Union and for their wallets, not to end slavery. He's not saying the South, that slavery wasn't important, that Southerners didn't view the institution as essential to their livelihood to protect slavery. He does say that that was part of it, but it wasn't everything. You know, Southerners were interested in a different type of economy. And a low tariff economy, a Jeffersonian economy. So this is a complex issue. Again, it's not sufficient to say when you say, well, the Civil War was about slavery. Well, you have to separate two different issues here. There's the war and there's secession. The war was not about slavery. The war was about money and saving the Union, invading the South and keeping them part of the Union. That's what the war was about, not slavery. The war was about Union. And he brings up a couple of very interesting quotes. He brings up one from Charles Adams. Charles Adams said, quote, if trade were to shift to the southern ports because of a free trade zone or extremely low duties relative to the North, then the great cities of the Northeast would go into decline and suffer economic disaster. The image painted by these editorials from newspapers of northern cities is one of massive unemployment, the closing of factories and businesses, followed by unrest, riots, and possibly revolution. The inland cities of the North would also go into decline, like Pittsburgh, where duty-free British steel and iron products would cripple the American steel industry. So, what he's saying is that Northern papers were editorializing, oh my gosh, if the South goes, our economy is sunk. We're not going to make it. He also brings up a quote from Ward Hill Lamon, who was Lincoln's legal partner for 5 years before the war and his personal bodyguard during the presidency. And he brings up why Southern secession was so frightening. He says, quote, cotton formed the bulk of our exchanges with Europe, paid our foreign indebtedness, maintained a great marine, built towns, cities, and railways, enriched factories, brokers, and bankers, filled the federal treasury to overflowing, and made the foremost nations of the world commercially our tributaries and politically our dependents. A short crop embarrassed and distressed all Western Europe. A total failure, a war, or non-intercourse would reduce whole communities to famine and probably precipitate them into revolution. So here he's saying the South can't go because we need their cotton. Follow the money is what Philip Lee is saying here. If you want to understand why the North invaded, it's not sufficient to ask why the South seceded. You can look at this as well. The South was being taxed. The South was thought they were a section that could never have any political control of the Union anymore. And so they wanted out to have independence. It's not sufficient to say why the South seceded, but more why the North invaded. They didn't have to. There was a choice there. They could say, all right, we're going to let the South go. Go in peace. We still have our government. We still have our Navy. We still have our Army. We still have our banking institution, our financial houses. We still have all of these things. The South didn't affect any of that. They were willing to purchase federal forts, property, to try to have some type of resolution with the Union, but that didn't happen. That didn't happen at all. The North decided to shoot at the South and force them back in the Union. So when you look at this whole issue of self-determination, when people say, well, I mean, this was treason. Treason against what? The South wasn't engaging in treason when they declared their independence from the United States. James Byard of Delaware pointed this out very forcefully in a speech in the Senate when he said, look, we still have all of these things. What is the point? Why are we going and waging a war of extermination, which is what we're doing? All for the money. You have to follow the money. And so this is why this particular piece is great, and it gets back into this Northern hypocrisy. You know, Northern view of the war is that, well, it's all about slavery. Slavery was only a Southern institution. Webster won the debate. This is the Northern view of the entire conflict. And so what we're trying to do is provide complexity. And then what would, you know, if we're looking at these philosophical intellectual exercises, what would an independent South look like? How would that change American politics? What would the South be able to do independently? So if we have these smaller states, decentralization, maybe even an 11-state confederacy, you know, Southern Confederacy is too big. You might need a state like Alabama being its own state or own country, a Mississippi. South Carolina, you know, there's 4 million people in Alabama. That's the size of the entire United States in 1790. So could it succeed on its own? Sure. But we don't think about these things because we think that the United States has to be a certain size from this border to that border and have this many people. But if you really think about it logically, well, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Until next time, good day.